Okay, so last time we finished up talking about security and access control by talking about sandboxing, where the basic idea is we wanted to give a program we were running less permissions than we typically have. Like my web browser normally shouldn't open my taxes. I'd like it to be able to run code and not have to worry about checking that code doesn't do anything bad, but have some higher level mechanism to enforce policies. And we said one way we could do this is by just allowing the operating system to let you specify a filter on system calls for the program. So we can just say, we're not going to let you open any new files. Then we don't have to worry about you opening new files. We don't have to check all the code we're running to make sure it never does that, even if it's buggy. And that's like a real approach real programs use to limit the impact of usually security vulnerabilities. Like, we don't want our buggy web browser to let web pages do bad things, so they can run the sensitive code that works on the web page in a restricted environment to do that. Then we talked about virtual machines, where, in particular, virtual machines were running a whole operating system, you know, alongside other operating systems, and we want to have this container for the operating system, which has an interface that looks like real hardware. We have this terminology that we say what's in that container is a guest OS, and what it's running in is the host OS. And we have a component which implements that called a hypervisor or virtual machine monitor, and its job is going to include tracking the virtual machine state. Like, does the guest OS think it's in kernel mode? Does the guest OS think interrupts are disabled? Like, does the guest OS think its page table base register is? All this state that's normally part of the hardware now needs to be tracked by the hypervisor instead, because it's going to be not the real machine state, because it will run the guest OS in user mode, which doesn't have its own fake kernel mode. And the basic implementation technique is this idea of track and emulate, that we're going to make sure all the operations that the guest OS wants to do that don't work the same way in our user mode container cause an exception. And our exception handler is going to imitate what that underlying operation would have done on real hardware and then do it. So for example, if it tries to read from the keyboard controller, we're going to make sure that triggers an exception, perhaps by making sure the memory that corresponds to that is not mapped as readable. And we're going to turn that into an equivalent operation like a read system call in the host OS. And then we're going to imitate it working, like set the registers resulting from the read, and keep running the guest OS. And we'll do that sort of procedure for every single operation that causes an exception. So this deals with doing what the CPU does correctly, handling exceptions and so on, but doesn't deal with memory. And virtual memory in a virtual machine is more tricky. And the big problem is that we have this page table that the guest has, and it's not what the hardware wants. The hardware wants a page table, that's going to be our shadow page table. Which goes from what we called virtual addresses, the guest OS's idea of virtual addresses, to machine addresses, to underlying machine addresses. And that's not the guest page table, and that's not our host OS normal page table. So we need to construct that in order to run the guest OS in user mode. And that's our shadow page table. And that maintaining that is the job of the hypervisor. And we had these two big options for filling it. So one option was to fill it on demand, that whenever there's a page, we first start it empty, and whenever there's a page fault, we do the lookup in the guest page table, fill in a shadow page table entry for that. And we know when to eliminate shadow page table entries because the guest OS needs to invalidate its TLB. We just pay attention to those TLB invalidations and update the shadow page table. And in this case, we can think of the shadow page table as sort of a virtual TLB. Another way is to maintain the shadow page table via trap and emulate. That what we want to happen is when the guest OS writes its guest page table, that turns into changing the shadow page table, or possibly multiple shadow page tables. So we can implement that by marking all the guest page tables as read-only, and whenever there's a write, we look at the page fault, you say, oh, it was because it was read-only, let's figure out what it was trying to access, and let's imitate that access by updating the guest page table and our shadow page tables before we return back to the guest OS. So any questions about things we talked about last time? And when we finished up, we talked about, we had our shadow page tables. You mentioned that we possibly had two. This is per process, and we have, if we're doing option two, we have one shadow page table for every, well, two shadow page tables for every process, that page table. So when we finished up last time, you mentioned that this means that we have a lot of more page table switches. We said we had around 6, and in this case, I believe, this is from when we have the read system call, we have a user to kernel switch, and remember we have a different shadow page tables for each, and then we had the kernel to other to kernel for the other program, and then kernel to user, then user to kernel, and then kernel to original kernel, because we switched back to the original program. And then we switched to user mode to return to the syscall, then so kernel to user. So this ended up being, and apologies for my bad handwriting, but each user to kernel switch required switching to a different shadow page table. Each process switch required switching to a different shadow page table. So we ended up with 6 real page table switches versus just, I think, we had 1 versus 2 in the original guest OS running on native hardware. And this is a lot slower, and if you remember when we talked about context switches, the main cost here is not actually changing the page table base register, but that we have cache misses from invalidating our TLB. So we have a bunch of things we're doing which actually seem a bit slow. So the other thing that's a bit slow is that we also have the extra overhead of things like the interrupt from the keyboard, and there's presumably reading from the keyboard controller. These are done via trap and emulate, so they're going to be, we're going to have to do this instruction interpretation and so on. So for all this stuff, we can speed this up if we have a little extra hardware support. And I'm going to talk about some of the types of hardware support that exist these days in most processors. I'm going to talk about first, VTX. And VTX is, hardware support for a VM running. And the idea is the hardware tracks whether we're in a virtual machine or not, just as a Boolean flag. And there's this new instruction called vmenter, which says start running a virtual machine. And this instruction, all at once, switches page table-based registers, jumps to a specific program counter, loads all the registers in an appropriate way, and the guest OS just runs normally, possibly in kernel mode. But the hardware knows that it's running as a virtual machine, so there's going to be this new special interrupt called the vmexit interrupt. And this interrupt is going to not be handled by the guest OS, but always by the hypervisor. And it's going to be triggered whenever the guest OS does something the hypervisor doesn't want it to do without the hypervisor getting involved. So the hypervisor gives the processor basically a little list of things it wants to trigger the VM exit interrupt. So that list could be like, whenever the guest OS tries to set the page table base register, run me, run the hypervisor, don't run the guest OS. Don't trigger a protection fault in the guest OS, run the hypervisor. But for other protection faults, just run the protection fault handler in the guest OS. So you can specify that level of granularity, so most things are still handled by the hardware, just like if a normal OS was running. But you have this special interrupt which runs the hypervisor and switches back to that. And so it's configurable, sort of what things cause a VM exit, and this is how you restrict what the virtual machine does. So you can say, page table updates. You can say you want page faults to trigger a VM exit or not, or maybe only some types of page faults. But if the virtual machine doesn't do any of the things which triggers that, it runs entirely normally, including switching between user and kernel mode, including doing normal page table lookups and caching, just as if it were running natively. So this gives you the tools to not do as much trap and emulate. So you can set up just the things you need to trap and emulate to do that, and you don't have any special cases. And this also means you only set up one shadow page table. You set the shadow page table as the real page table, you have its user and kernel mode bits set normally, and now we've avoided a whole bunch of those page table switches. We just have a shadow page table per process, we switch to it, it has user and kernel mode bits, the hardware switches between user and kernel mode, and that's fine. And when this VM exit is triggered, the processor will change the currently active page table for us, so we don't have to worry about trying to sneak our hypervisor in the virtual machine's memory. It's going to be a separate address space. Okay, so questions about this idea? I know I'm going through this very quickly, and also omitting lots of details about like what's the level of configuration, because I didn't look it up, and I don't think that's exceptionally important, exactly what level of detail you have. Okay, so this is sort of hardware support, where the idea is we're going to reuse the hardware's user and kernel mode infrastructure, mostly, but still allow the virtual machine monitor, the hypervisor, to get exceptions when it wants them. Now, this helped our virtual memory situation a bit. So we now don't have two shadow page tables, we have one, but the hardware can do a lot better. And there's two big things the hardware can do which really help out with this. So one thing the hardware can do is it can have tag TLBs. So our TLB can have an address space ID, which is basically like the page table based register value in the TLB entries. And this means that we can share our TLB even though we switch the page table base register. We can have the TLB cache things for a process which isn't running right now. So if we switch to a process and switch back, or switch to a different shadow page table and switch back, we still have things from the old shadow page table. So this is actually really helpful for normal OSs because it makes context switching faster. That if we switch to one program and then to another and then back to the original, maybe we still have things in our TLB now. But this is also useful for our hypervisor because I said our big problem was we were doing all these page table switches. This will make them a lot less expensive even when we have to do them. And in particular, it will make them less expensive in our VM exit case because, remember, we switch page tables when we're running the virtual machine and switch back. And that seems like that makes trap and emulate really expensive. Now we've avoided that. Because we'll have our virtual machine pages cached and our guest OS pages cached in the TLB at the same time. Okay, so questions about this idea? So this is not transparent because there's extra work for the guest OS or for an OS using this or a hypervisor using this to do. And the big thing is that because a page table that's not active might be cached in the TLB, you need to take that into account and make sure that those TLB entries get invalidated when you update these non-active page tables. And there's instructions for invalidate everything with this address space ID and so on to do that. So that's only a little bit of help. But the hardware can really help by doing what's called nested page tables. So remember, we had this three-stage lookup, and what I'm doing so far is I'm building this shadow page table, which does this, and maintaining that is just very annoying. And having to only maintain one helped a little bit, but one per process, but still very annoying. So what we can have instead happen is the hypervisor could specify two page table-based registers instead of one. And the hardware can do this two-level mapping for us. So we just implement in the hardware, instead of doing a normal page table lookup, it does two chain page table lookups. And we have a way of specifying the guest page table-based register as a physical address, and the hypervisor page table-based register as a machine address, and the hardware does the guest into hypervisor lookup. So, and the hardware needs to handle some of the details here, that namely the guest page table contains physical addresses, including its internal pointers are physical addresses. So if it's a multi-level table, the first level contains physical page numbers, not machine page numbers in my virtual physical machine terminology. But the hardware will just handle all that using the hypervisor page table whenever it needs to do a lookup. Right. So this is something that's really nice for the hardware to do. It will make things a lot faster. It's not the most trivial thing for the hardware to do. So one thing is, so let's say I have two level page tables. You know, each of these two page table based registers are two levels. So this is two level, and this is two level. So how many lookups could I have to translate an address in this case? How many memory accesses? I'll give you so who thinks we have? So who thinks we have at least four? Okay. Who thinks we can have more than four? Okay. More than five? More than six? Okay. So someone who said more than five, want to explain where that came from? Where it counts? Yeah. So it's something like that. And this picture might make it clearer what's going on. In that each of these is a physical access here. So we have a physical access, so yeah. So our worst case, yeah. So we have to look up at each level, we have to do a two-level translation. And then look up something in the based on that translation. So we take our guest pointer, which is not a machine address, it's a physical address. We look that up in the hypervisor's page table, so that's 1, 2, and then we read the guest's page table finally to find the appropriate entry in there. But that gives us a physical page number, not a machine page number. So we need to look that up again in the hypervisor's page table and then read that. Then use that to figure out where the second level of the guest page table is. Then we have to take the physical page number we get out of that and look it up again. And you were pointing out that, well, we had these lookups, and after each one of them, we have to do a hypervisor lookup. These two. And you, I think you just missed, which this, the subtlety that we have a guest page pointer, but obviously the hypervisor could translate that very just once for us. So it's understandable we might not need that. But you can see here we have the hardware doing a lot of memory lookups for one memory access. Like this kind of explosion, and this is just with two levels. If you think about real 64-bit x86, it's four levels for each table. So we end up with around 1620 lookups for one memory access. But that's what the hardware has to do. But it turns out, because of how hardware often implements page table lookups, that it's practical to do that, because apparently the common way of implementing page table lookups is to basically run a little code which is hard-coded on the processor. And you can just change that code to do a more complicated lookup. Okay, so any questions about nested page tables? And so this is, what VirtualBox tries to use, and it sure makes things a lot faster. Especially if you're like doing lots of memory allocation. Like, so it's really useful, and that's why it's worth implementing this sort of complexity in the hardware. Okay, so something I alluded to earlier, talking about virtual machines, is that for drop and emulate, we assume that we could make everything cause an exception. And this is the big reason why we wanted vmenter, because x86 was not one of them. vmenter, fixes this. vmenter makes it so all these things cause exceptions now, but before that, x86 wasn't one of them. And the reason why was a bit subtle, and that this shows you like how you can misdesign an architecture. So the biggest problem was an instruction called popf. So popf pops flags from the stack. So the idea is you save your flags, like condition codes, and so on, to the stack so you can restore them later. So this is like handy for implementing like a context switch. It seems like a perfectly innocent instruction. But unfortunately, we have some special flags. We have a flag called the IO privilege level and a flag called the interrupt enable flag. The interrupt enable flag is literally just, are interrupts enabled or not? And x86 at some point decided we'll store it in the same place as the carry flag and the sign flag. Maybe not the best decision, but it's the decision they made. But you say, how does this work in kernel mode? Because this reads them from the stack and puts them in the flags. So what happens if I popf to disable interrupts in a user mode program? And the answer is, well, that x86 said, well, popf's pretty common. And people look like, we want people to be able to like just set the condition code. So we're just going to ignore changes to the interrupt flag and the IO privilege level in user mode. We aren't going to trigger an exception or anything like that. We're just going to ignore them. So this was clearly a design mistake, but it's a design mistake which was made a long time ago, before anyone really thought of virtual machines. So they're kind of stuck with it. They can't change it, because there's probably programs somewhere which rely on this working this way. But it's really problematic, because this is an instruction operating systems rely on working. And they probably actually are saving the interrupt flag when they're doing that, or restoring the interrupt flag when they're doing that. Another issue is pushf. So pushf is the complement to popf. And this is more subtle. So pushf, its behavior is exactly the same in user and kernel mode. It just pushes the flags to the stack. But the problem is, the hypervisor wants to pretend that the interrupts are disabled when they really aren't. And even though this instruction is doing the same thing in user and kernel mode, it's telling you whether interrupts are enabled on the real hardware, not the hypervisor's fake machine. So the hypervisor needs to make this instruction not actually run the real instruction. And this is one of the things that the hardware virtualization support basically allowed the hypervisor to say, no, really trigger an exception for this, so I can make it do something different. Or alternately, like, here's the value I want you to push. But that's, you know, that's a more subtle reason we need it. So even though this instruction's the same in user and kernel mode, it doesn't let us have our pretend machine have interrupts disabled. So the ways we deal with that, so one option is you patch the OS. So when you're dealing with things like this, it's actually not too bad to patch the OS because there's not too many places where the operating system is using pushf and popf. Now typically, there's probably like really important places like the interrupt handler code, but that's a small part of the OS and you just change that little piece. And that's why it's not like a big, you aren't like saying redesign your OS to use my virtual machine. You're just saying, you know, just change your trap.s a little bit. And this is often what's meant by paravirtualization. One of the things they'll do is they'll just replace those with hypervisor system calls, basically. So another option is binary translation, that you can compile machine code into new machine code. And a reason why this is more practical is that you can do this for only the kernel code, and only if it uses these instructions. So because a relatively small part of the kernel uses this, this isn't actually that bad to do. And there were many commercial VMs which got good performance doing it. Because they're not, like, they're changing only a little bit of code, even though they're using this rather expensive technique to do it. And the third option is just change the instruction set. And that's the modern solution, is that we have this new VM enter instruction, and one of the things it does is it lets you actually get an exception now, so you don't need to worry about patching the operating system. Okay, so any questions about virtual machines? Okay, so I'm going to talk about, you know, my last bonus topic, which is about different OS designs. And the big thing about the operating system design we looked at is that it puts almost everything in the kernel. The kernel does a lot of stuff. And this design is known as a monolithic kernel, because the kernel is huge. It has scheduling, sockets, devices, pipes, file systems, virtual memory, including memory replacement, and all sorts of other services. Threading, thread synchronization, partly, like all sorts of things are implemented in the kernel, just whatever is convenient. So there's an alternate OS design philosophy, which has been popular, and there are some real OSs based on this that are used, but typically not in the desktop domain, called a microkernel philosophy. And here the idea is we want to make the kernel as small as possible. And to do that, we're going to pull some things that were in the kernel into processes. So rather than having devices in the kernel, we're going to have our device drivers as a process. And we're going to have our file system as a process. We're going to have our network driver and our socket implementation as a process. And the idea of this, well, one idea is that this is more modular. If I want to have a new network implementation or a new device driver, I don't need to replace or supplement my kernel. I just load a process just like running a normal program. Another hope is that this means that I'm less susceptible to like bugs in my file system or so on. That if I have a buggy file system, it's limited in what it can do because it's just a process. We can kill the buggy file system and anything not using it is okay. If I have a bug in my file system in the kernel, well, who knows what happened. Here, so we can isolate the effects of buggy file systems or device drivers to just the things that were depending on them. So in this design, the big thing the kernel is doing and the most important service of the kernel is providing communication between our applications and these services. And in particular, it matters much more that we have fast inter-process communication in a microkernel design, because previously, you know, something was just a system call, and now it seems like it's two system calls, at least. You know, one system call to send a message to the device driver, another system call for the device driver to send a message back to me. And also, we have any other cost of communicating. If we have to copy that message a couple more times, that might end up being a lot slower than our monolithic kernel. And this is usually the main concern which drives people to this monolithic design, is that it's hard to provide really fast communication, or perhaps even when you do, it's still going to be a bit slower than what the monolithic kernel can do, where when you call read, it just accesses your memory directly. So the other thing the kernel needs to do is it needs to somehow provide device drivers and network drivers and so on the access they need to the underlying hardware to do their jobs. So it needs to provide an interface that looks like what the device driver wants, but that's accessible from user mode, where we can't just add something to the trap function. So we need some modular way of doing the equivalent of that. So in our microkernel, so I said we have inter-process communication. So we also need this raw access to devices, and there's two other very important things we need, and that we'd like to try to make simpler. And one is CPU scheduling. We need that because it's tied to inter-process communication, so we can't easily implement it elsewhere. There's ways you could try, but like when I send a message to someone who's waiting for it, they need to start running. So there needs to be some integration of this communication with the scheduling. And we also need virtual memory and some sort of virtual memory support, but we're going to want to do a lot less because in our monolithic kernel design, remember our virtual memory support was very tied with our device and file system support. And if we have our device driver outside the kernel, then it can't work that way. It has to work in some different way. So I'm going to go through an example microkernel, and I'm going to use SEL4. So I'm choosing SEL4, because it's a used microkernel that has good literature about it. It's most notable not because it's a popular microkernel, but because it's formally verified. So sometime a couple years ago, the people who developed this, who are from universities in Australia, did the effort of doing a machine-checked proof of some correctness properties of this kernel, which is the first time this has been done for an operating system, basically. And you know, it was like 30, 40 person years of work. It uses things which seem like they should not be necessary, like writing the kernel in Haskell and then converting that to C. To have something you can machine check, but they did it. But it uses a microkernel design. We're not going to focus on the formally verified part, though that is the most interesting thing about this design. We're going to focus on what does this microkernel design look like. And it's a good microkernel design because it has foresight from past microkernel designs, which maybe weren't so great. But some of the choices it makes because it wants to be formally verifiable, which maybe you wouldn't care about in some other microkernel designs. So this is a So in the default configuration, there's some other features you could have in your kernel. This is the full list of system calls SEL4 has. This is all of them. And you might say, some things are missing here. So I can do IPC. There's a whole bunch of IPC system calls and a yield system call, which just runs the scheduler, doesn't take any arguments. Okay, so how can I make that, you know, actually do things like allocate memory, set my virtual memory pointer, how can I get interrupts? And the answer is that any of those operations are done using these same system calls, but you send a message to a kernel object. So rather than sending a message to something that is a device driver, use the same syntax, but the thing you're sending the message to is a kernel object instead of a device driver. This means that a device driver can stand in for any kernel objects and have the exact same interface. And they can change like what parts are implemented in the kernel later on, potentially. Okay. So that's how everything's just these messages. Okay, so we have just send, receive, and some variations, and this combination send, receive, which is not needed for correctness, but helps us make it faster in the common case where you want to send a message and get a reply. So you have to say, where do you send and receive from? And SEL4 uses capabilities. So it says, hardcore believer in capabilities. Everything is capabilities, which is this opaque tokens that include the allowed operations and point to something. That can be a kernel object. We'll talk about what the kernel objects are in a bit. Or it can be another program you're talking to. But you get a capability that allows you to talk, do things with it. And also, capabilities are one of the things you're going to be allowed to send in your messages. So you can send some data in those messages, and you can also send a couple capabilities to another program, you know, to either identify something or to let it access something. And the message passing implementation is going to handle like copying that and making that all work. So we have these things. So first I'll talk about the objects. So these are things that are implemented in the kernel, and they have methods, but the methods are just you send a message, and the message has a tag saying, this method is the one I want to do. You send that message, you get back a reply, which is the result of that operation. And so there are a bunch of types of kernel objects. I have the main ones here. So there's a kernel object representing capability storage. So if you have a thread, it has capabilities it can use. This is its file descriptor table, basically. So this is, you know, kind of like the file descriptor table, that just that array. So you have a way of specifying, this is the array I have, and passing that around, or setting up a new one. You have a TCB. So you have something that just represents a thread control block. So you can ask to create a new thread control block. You can set the attributes of the thread control block, and like what the register values are and what the PC is and so on. You have things for IPC. So you have something known as an endpoint. That's a slice you can send messages to or receive messages using. So that's basically like a pipe file descriptor. And a notification, which is kind of like a semaphore. Then you have virtual memory. And for virtual memory, this is on x86 32-bit. That's what I meant to put there. So you have an object representing a page directory. That's the first level page table, and a page table, which is the second level page table. Also have objects representing available memory. So this is how you don't just say, allocate me some memory. You have an object representing a frame of memory you can access, or this untyped thing I'll talk about in a bit. But that just represents some available chunk of memory that you have. And this is, for example, this frame is what you'd use with our page table to say, hey, I would like to be able to access this memory, put it in my page table. And there's also things representing interrupts. So you can say, I would like to handle this interrupt, and you can tell the kernel, set up the handler for this interrupt number to send a message to me. So something you can note in here is that SEL4 is trying to expose basically the hardware pretty directly and its underlying implementation pretty directly. Like, it exposes a thread control block. Like, it just says, here's what my thread control block uses. Tell me what to set in it. It exposes the page directory. It doesn't ask you, you don't say, map me this memory. You say, set this part of the page directory to this. And this is part of keeping the kernel simple, that the kernel services really are just doing something you could have done manually, but we have to like make sure that you don't set the page table to point to the memory you don't have. But we just say, you tell me how to set the page table, I'm not going to do anything intelligent about that. So another choice they've made is that they don't do any kernel memory allocation. That when you want memory, you have to start out with these types representing available memory, and you have to use those. There's no malloc system call. There's no service like that. You just get those references to memory, and the kernel will use that memory. And if not, you don't. And the idea is that if you wanted to implement something like malloc, you'd have a server, a service that you talk to, which would send you the capabilities for frames or untypes and manage the system's memory outside of the kernel. And all the kernel would see is that, yes, you were given this, it's okay. You were given this memory, it's okay, you can use it or not. And SEL4 goes further than most other operating system microkernels in this respect, in that it does this even for kernel objects. So if you want to allocate a thread control block, we're used to saying that, well, the kernel needs to like call kalloc to do that, or have a table of some size, or you want, or like, but that's not the way SEL4 works. SEL4 says that you have to give the kernel memory when you want it to have a new thread control block. You have to give it memory if you want it to have a new page directory, and so on, even though you don't access that memory directly. And the justification for this is, well, if we're thinking about running things in a verifiable way, we want to be able to prove that we won't run out of memory. And this scheme lets you prove you won't run out of memory. And it would be a lot harder if random things could allocate memory. Also, it lets you make sure that a program uses only a megabyte of memory, including the stuff that's used on its behalf in the kernel, which you can't really enforce in other ways. You have to worry about, well, how much space does the pipe use? Here, you allocate the space for all those resources. Like when you set up an endpoint for to receive messages, there's a certain amount of space for buffers in that, and that's what you got. And we don't have to worry about, are you going to exhaust my memory? So the way SEL4 makes it so that user programs, handle allocating memory is that all the memory starts as untyped objects. So the first program that runs gets this big array of untyped objects representing all physical memory, besides like the boot up part. And when it wants to do something like make a new thread control block, what it says, it doesn't say, tell the kernel, make a new thread control block. It says, here's an untyped object, convert it to a thread control block for me. So in order to allocate any object, you need to start with one of these untyped objects, which are initialized at boot. And if you want to allocate memory, you convert one of those to a frame. So a frame is an untyped object that you can access directly. And the idea is that an untyped object is either a TCB or one of those other kernel objects, or it turns into a frame, and you can only have one thing derived from it at a time. So once you've turned an untyped object into a TCB, you can't also turn it into a frame, which means you can't access that memory directly. So the kernel's still controlling what's in the TCB. You can't change that without calling the kernel's methods for that. So questions about this idea? Yeah.
So does this mean that all kernel objects are the same size?
So the question is, does this mean all kernel objects are the same size? So no. This is something I glossed over here. So untyped objects are variable size, and you can split untyped objects into multiple untyped objects. So there's a particular size the kernel expects for a TCB, which you have to supply, but you can take a big untyped object and split it into smaller ones to get that. So that's how they deal with that. So you have something that looks kind of like this, so there's some other stuff going on here, which I'll may talk about later, but you have like an untyped object you get at boot, and you split that into multiple ones, and then you like allocate an endpoint or whatever else in there. But yes, they do realize that, yes, if you know, we aren't saying that all the kernel objects are the same size, and don't do that. Okay. So we have objects. And objects are represented, as I said, by capabilities. So each capability takes a slot in the C node. The C node has a certain size, but it can be hierarchical. That's how you don't run out. And you can copy them, and so on. So one thing we have here is we need to deal with, you know, we have allocating objects, but what about deleting objects? What happens when I want to get rid of a thread? How do I make that happen? So something the kernel needs to do is when you get rid of a thread, you have a capability to it, but you might have copied that capability to a whole bunch of other places. Like maybe there's a whole bunch of device drivers which have a capability for that thread that they might want to try to use. So one thing the kernel does for this is it tracks the reference count, basically, of all the objects, so it doesn't delete things while there's still a capability. And when it tracks when things are deleted, so it knows when you can use the untyped object you started with again for something else. It won't let you use the untyped object for two things at once, but you can use it for one thing and then another thing later on. And also, the kernel needs to know where all the capabilities are stored, so when you like delete a capability storage thing, it will delete all the capabilities in there recursively. Now, this doesn't let you delete things nicely. So if you think about the case I talked about where a whole bunch of device drivers, which are just, remember, processes now, have a capability for my thread control block, it seems like now I need the cooperation of all those device drivers to actually free up my thread's memory, even if I just want to kill it right now. So there's a solution for this in SCL4, which is that they track this parent-child relationship for capabilities. So when you make when you pass a capability for your thread control block, you'll pass a derived capability. And the idea is you can revoke the parent, which is different than deleting it, and that deletes all the derived ones and makes them, instead of referring to the original object, refer to this thing which, if you try to use it, returns an error. So this way, now we can take our thread control block away from all those device drivers which have it, and when they try to like start our thread again, it won't work. It will just return an error to them. And I have the example on the slide of like an endpoint. So we have a device driver, the device driver is working, we have a way of accessing it. It's like a file descriptor for it, basically, and it goes away. It can revoke the parent of that, and that means that now when we try to send a message to it, we'll get back a sorry, it's not working anymore. and we can get rid of the device driver while things are still trying to use it. And this gives us this little tree. So this is one of the things the kernel needs to track, because the kernel needs to say, well, I don't want anyone to access this device driver anymore. I'm getting rid of the endpoint used to access it. So we get rid of this, and we also get rid of all the derived endpoints that have been copied into different threads. And I'll talk about what badge means in a bit. But other questions about this? Yeah. Okay, so I talked about sort of our objects and so on, and deleting and creating them. So let's also talk about messages, since messages are our most important thing, since everything turns into a message. So messages have a tag, which is our message type and size. So when we have a kernel object, this type includes what am I trying to do? Am I trying to set an entry into my page table or something else? It's to another program, they decide how to interpret that. It's just a number. It can include a badge. So in this is something to help out server. So let's say I have a device driver which handles accesses for, like, implement sockets. And I have multiple things using me for sockets, and I want to know which one is trying to write to a socket. What I can do is create new versions of the endpoint to contact me, which have a badge on them. And the idea of the badge is that all the messages sent will have this information telling me it came from this version of your endpoint, so I can figure out who it came from. And this also allows me to do things like have one server that does multiple things, and I, you know, pretend I'm multiple servers at once, but I just have one endpoint which gets messages for multiple things, and I figure out which one it is from the batch. So, like, I can implement a device driver for 10 different devices and pretend it's 10 different device drivers. So messages also have a few message words. So messages in SCL4 are deliberately pretty small. The idea is, if you want to pass something large, what you should do instead is pass a capability for a frame and share memory. Otherwise, the kernel is just going to send a few words. And the first few, for speed, are going to be stored in CPU registers. Like, we're just going to reserve a few registers for messages. And the rest are going to be stored in a per-thread buffer. We aren't going to, like, allocate space in the stack. We're just going to say, when you create your thread control block, part of that thread control block is a message buffer, basically. And you can also send capabilities, and these are copied. And the idea is, part of receiving a message, we'll put them in your capability storage, depending on how you specify to receive the message. Okay. So that's the format of messages. But we also need to figure out how do we send messages. And SCL4 makes this choice, which is not what we've seen in, like, XV6 for, like, pipes. So SCL4 messages are synchronous. When you send, it doesn't complete until the receive happens. It does what's known as a rendezvous. And the big advantage of this from a performance point of view is that the message isn't copied. That because we're pausing your thread while it's sending, we just, you know, have the message there. And in the ideal case, our fast path is going to be that the message is entirely in registers. And what we do the program that's trying to receive the message already called receive. And in that case, what send is going to do is it's going to context switch to the program where that's receiving it, and it's not going to change the registers the message is in. So the cost of sending a message is literally a context switch where we save less than a normal context switch. And that's the hope. Of course, that we might not have that case, so we might have to do something slower. Okay, so questions on this idea? So our send is going to do if we think about the system call implementation, it has a few cases. So one case is we're sending to a kernel object. Like there's something implemented in the kernel, like a page table. In that case, we're going to have this kernel handler we invoke and reply. If we're sending to a program that's ready to receive, we're ready to receive includes that we should schedule it, that's eligible to be scheduled now, like it's not too low priority. We'll just switch to it immediately. And this is how we make it way faster than like pipes in XV6. Because in XV6, you write to a pipe, and what that does is it adds something to a buffer, copies it to a buffer in the kernel, and then it marks, and then it looks for the process that's waiting on that buffer, marks that process as runnable, and then keeps going until that process eventually gets scheduled. Here, we're making things much faster. We're just going to go right to the program that's going to take our message. And if the program's not ready to receive, because send is synchronous, it, waits for the receiver message to be received, we're just going to add our thread to a queue of things waiting to be received from that thread. So each thread is going to have a, each endpoint is going to have a queue of waiting threads. We'll just add ourselves to that queue and wait. And if you send to an invalid destination, we're going to reply with an error, just like someone, a service actually replying. So questions about these cases? And you can see here how the choice of send doesn't finish until we receive simplifies our implementation. And there's also these send receive plus receive system calls, which aren't called send receive, but there's these single system calls that do a send and receive. And the idea here is that we can have our common case for contacting a server be that we context switch to the server for the send, and then we context switch back when it sends back its reply for our receive. So in some sense, the only extra cost we have over something implemented in the kernel is we have an extra two extra context switches. And we'll just work to make those context switches as fast as possible. So one thing SEL4 does is it uses a tag TLB whenever that's supported. So the address space switch keeps things cached in the TLB. And the other thing it does is like it doesn't change all the registers if it doesn't need to. So in this way, our fast case is really fast. And we can do this with a combined system call, and we need a combined system call because we want to make sure that immediately after we send, we're marked as ready to receive right away, which we couldn't do if we had to wait to get start running again and then call receive. And this is the fast path, but we still have our backup case where we'll wait and add ourselves to a queue. Okay. So questions? Yes. So this is typical message sending. So you can see that they've really worked on making it so we shouldn't have to spend much extra cost contacting servers. And this means that the performance might not be as good as a fully optimized monolithic kernel, but it's very close, even though we're implementing these services outside the kernel. They also have asynchronous IPC via notifications. And I told you that these were like semaphores. So these are like binary semaphores. It's actually like a little array of binary semaphores, but basically it's binary semaphores, but you can signal or wait multiple at once. So they implement that just because sometimes you want to do things which don't work with the model of send waiting for someone to receive it. So you can signal and forget, or you can coordinate multiple threads this way. And this is the microkernel's minimal mechanism for that. They just implement binary semaphores, and that's about it. So that's messages. So the other big thing that's different in SEL4 is virtual memory. And I also previewed the idea that we have this page directory and page table object. So when you set up your thread control block, you say, this is the page directory it uses. And you can send messages to these objects to map pages. You can say, hey, I want this entry in this page table to point to this frame. And the kernel will do that. And the kernel also, as it's doing that, and the reason it has to do that for you, is it will track how many people are using this frame so you never have a pointer to invalid memory that you can access. Now, this deals with mapping memory, but there's a whole bunch of things we did, like in our paging and protection project, which it seems like the kernel can't do here. Like, say, copy and write. And the answer here is you can do that yourself, that the kernel's not going to implement copy and write, but it's going to provide you with the tools you need to do it. And the big thing we're missing so far is you need a way of getting a page fault. So one of the things that SEL4 lets you do is with a thread, you specify a place to send messages to on exceptions. So anytime there's a page fault, the kernel's page fault handler, what it's going to do is going to turn that into a send system call. So you can set up a page fault handler server and have it get that message, and it can have a capability for your page directory and page table, and it can do the copy and write operation for you. And then it replies to that message, and that just restarts your thread, just like returning from an exception handler did in XV6. So this is the way in which, you know, it still lets you do all those things our monolithic kernel does, but it does them outside the kernel now, by just exposing that sort of functionality. And this applies to all the other exceptions, you know, that you just have a way of forwarding it to a server, the server can handle it, and send a reply back to do whatever it needs to do. So questions about, any questions? This is all I have on SEL4. So any questions on SEL4 overall? Yeah.
Just in general, so you said that these microkernels usually aren't used on like desktop interfaces. What are they used for?
So question, what are these used for? So these are more popular in the embedded environments, just partly because they're easier to verify correctness of, and partly because just of history, like, a lot of why desktop operating systems look the way they do is because we don't really want to change operating systems that much. And if you're like making a custom device, that's a lot easier to say we're going to use a new OS on it. You know, I guess for SEL4 in particular, a big attraction is that it has this formal verification, which you just can't do for anything else. So if you need something that has a high level of assurance of correctness, you might use it for that reason. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So you said we share memory by sending frames.
Yeah.
How do we make sure that different page tables don't point to the same memory, share memory that way?
So the question is, how do we make sure that when we have these page tables, that different ones don't accidentally share memory in some other way? So the answer, so when you set your, do your virtual memory, you send messages to the page table and page directory to map objects. And the kernel's going to make sure that you have a capability for that frame when you do that. You're going to send not the address you want to map, you're going to send a frame object, frame capability. And it's going to look at that and say, yes, you have access to this. And it's going to track information about the frame, noting that you have a reference to it in your page table. And so, and the idea is that you won't be able to get a frame object for memory you're not supposed to have access to. That, so if either you'll never get it because it was never allocated to you, or it was allocated to you but it's going to be revoked, so when you pass it to the kernel you have instead a placeholder revoked capability, and it's going to say, can't map that for you, sorry. And also, because we're tracking where the frames are, if we revoke one, the kernel wouldn't configure out possibly what page tables it's in. I'm not actually sure whether they do that or they just say you can't revoke frames, but one of those two choices will deal with the issue of what if someone deallocates memory and I still have a reference to it. So, other questions? So I guess I should say as history, so SEL4 is a recent example of this design, but this idea has existed for a long time with lots of variations. SEL4 is probably one of the more successful of them. There's a few others which are commercially used, but they never really caught on in the desktop space, arguably. OS X is based on a microkernel called Mach, but if you look at how OS X actually works, it looks more like this than like this. And that's a thing which often happens to, like, also Windows NT was based on a microkernel design, but it doesn't really look like one anymore. In terms of, they just put more things in the kernel. Okay, and in my last few minutes, I'll go over some other, like, just mentioning that there are other OS designs. So one thing to mention, is exokernel. So exokernel was this different philosophy, which SEL4 is definitely inspired by. And in exokernel, their idea was the kernel shouldn't implement any abstractions. No abstractions whatsoever. All the kernel does is multiplexes resources. Abstractions are for libraries. Libraries shouldn't be in the kernel. So you provide exactly or almost exactly the hardware interface. If it's safe, you provide direct access. And your only job is when you get a request from a program, you filter it for safety. So like we saw this with virtual memory in SEL4, you make sure that they have access to that page. That's all you do. You don't do any sort of other page table management. So SEL4 does some things that exokernel did something, had some things in their design, which SEL4 doesn't do. So one idea was taking back pages from programs. So they still wanted to have like resource management, because that's one thing SEL4 doesn't do. Once you give memory to a program, it's there. They have the memory. And so their mechanism for this sort of thing was that the kernel has some way of telling the library in the program, I'm going to take this page back. You have 50 milliseconds to figure out what to do about that. And if you don't do it, sorry. Bad things are going to happen. That was their design idea for dealing with that, is that they have this advisory, they keep the library informed, and the idea here is that the library knows what's going on in the program better than the kernel does, and we're not going to do any funny things of like least recently used to guess what page to take back. We're just going to ask the program, what page should I take? And this is the same philosophy they wanted to apply to all resources, that just ask the program what to do and have the program handle it because it knows better. They also did this for example, network multiplexing. They just said, we're not going to have sockets. You can have sockets yourself. You can implement that in a library. We're just going to implement a send packet, receive packet, and we're going to have a filter, which is just like, what port numbers do you have? That's all we're going to do, is make sure you only send packets or receive packets you're supposed to handle. You handle the rest in your library. And they did the same even for CPU multiplexing. So the kernel doesn't keep thread control blocks. It just says, library OS, you tell me where to start running you. You manage your thread control block based on that. That's your job. You know where it's stored. And you tell me, where to do exceptions. So like on an exception, I'm going to start running, when your time slice is over, I'm not just going to switch away from you. I'm going to start running some code that you choose to save your thread state. And if that's not fast enough, well, sorry, you have a time limit, you exhaust it, too bad. If there's I/O, I'm going to tell you that the I/O happened and let you decide what to do. I'm not going to choose to schedule the thread or not. I'm just going to say, there's I/O, you do it, you tell me what to do. All I'm doing is making sure I'm only forwarding I/O that you're allowed to handle to you, and not some other way. So this is with this extreme idea that, you know, of minimizing the OS, not in, just in the sense of having these device drivers and such outside the kernel, but in a different idea where that we'd have them inside each program, but we'd have the kernel, the core part, only manage the I want to run multiple programs safely part, and absolutely nothing else, and leave everything, delegate everything else to the program on the theory that it knows better. And the idea would be that typical programs, there would just be the standard implementation of the library you'd use. But if you wanted to have like your really fast database, you could customize that to handle the things you want to do. Like if you want to evict pages in a special way, you can do that now. And this would give maximum flexibility to applications. That was the hope. This is one idea from research. And you can see that parts of this sort of caught on in SEL4. Like SEL4 does something similar to this, but it's not quite so extreme. Like they have some real abstractions in their message passing that they clearly, you know, care about the kernel implementing. Whereas the exokernel design would say, that's too many abstractions, get rid of that. Okay. So another sort of design philosophy for OSs that I'd like to mention, which didn't really pan out, was a project known as Singularity out of Microsoft Research. And in this design, rather than having our programs just be like assembly machine code that we load, they said they're going to be bytecode. They used CIL, which is the .NET bytecode. They just said, that's what our program's going to be. Our OS is just going to run .NET bytecode. And because it's bytecode, we're not going to use page tables. We're just going to run it in the physical memory because the bytecode ensures that we don't have accesses to memory you're not supposed to access. And you know, we're going to use that to deal with our isolation. Now, this is probably impractical these days for reasons that weren't known in 2003 to 2007. And the biggest issue these days is probably that like Spectre and Meltdown probably need hardware mitigations. So software-based isolation isn't enough. But otherwise, the idea of software-based isolation is really attractive. And the argument they made is that for some programs, the cost of paging is actually pretty high. It depends what your program's doing, obviously. And it depends on how well your hardware implements paging. So these numbers may be very different now. But their idea was that there's some cost of runtime checks, but that might be smaller than the cost of paging and user and kernel mode switching and all that we can avoid with this design. Because the thing we're avoiding besides page tables is we're avoiding when you make a system call, now it's just a function call. It's literally just a function call. There's no saving things whatsoever. And that was the thrust. But yeah, as I said, big practical issue these days is that information leaks, you probably need hardware to help you with that. Like Spectre and Meltdown, which are the ideas that that because we're sharing a cache with the same addresses, you might be able to infer things about the kernel's memory. And you probably need hardware help with that. And that's probably going to impose these costs again. The other like thing which makes people skeptical of this idea is you need to verify the bytecode to machine code compiler. You don't need to verify that it like works completely, but you need to verify that it won't introduce memory errors. Like it's okay if like produces the wrong answer. It's not okay if it uses a bad pointer. But that's really hard. It's hard to convincingly verify compared to that the hardware isolation works correctly. Okay, so that's all the topics I have. So next time, I'll do exam review, whatever you want to talk about. Also, I sent out a survey about workload. If I'd appreciate knowing about so I can like think about adjusting things for next semester, you know, figure out what assignments shouldn't be next to each other and things like that, and what how things might change. Thank you.